I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news. It's New Year's Eve, but the future does not look bright for a new proposal to give Americans $2,000 in COVID-19 relief. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell paired the measure with legislation Democrats don't support. And the window to hammer out a deal has nearly closed for a new Congress that will get sworn in next week. Smaller relief payments are on the way as employment remains high. And Scott Horsley, NPR chief economics correspondent, joins us now to talk more about this. And Scott, most Republicans didn't support this $2,000 check addition, but then President Trump insisted on it. So what actually happened when McConnell stepped in?
Yeah, you know, a handful of Republicans did support the larger payments, including at least this week, the two who are competing in the Georgia runoff. But most don't like the idea. And the president's outspoken support for $2,000 payments put those senators in a tough spot. You know, they had to either go against their own preferences or go against the president. So McConnell, as is his habit, saved them the trouble of having to cast an awkward vote by saddling the $2,000 payment idea with two unrelated provisions that are essentially lead weights that are going to sink the payment idea before it ever gets to the Senate floor.
Okay. If the $2,000 checks, though, do eventually get passed, that money would go to most Americans, including households with six-figure incomes. Is that the most efficient way to help the economy or even fair?
Well, it's not the most efficient way. Certainly, there are millions of struggling families who would welcome an extra $2,000 per person. You know, people who've lost their jobs or lost hours or otherwise seen their worlds upended by this pandemic. But there are also millions of others whose work and household budgets have been largely unaffected. And under the bill passed by the House, they'd get $2,000 apiece too. Mm-hmm. The pandemic has affected different Americans very differently. And so sending the same payment to everyone, regardless of circumstance, is perhaps not the best way to help those, to get help to those who really need it the most.
Yeah, we actually had a question from a listener who asked if there was any discussion on redistributing COVID relief money. Could people who don't need it give it back to the government?
Yeah, I've heard some questions along those lines as well, and I've heard from people who say, look, I don't need the relief money, and I plan to donate it to my local food bank or whatever, and I'm sure that sort of generosity will be welcome. Again, though, if the goal is to, you know, help the hungry or help people facing eviction, maybe the government should just do that directly rather than sending out blanket payments and then counting on people's charitable impulses to redirect the money elsewhere.
Congress did manage to pass an aid package last week that includes smaller $600 relief checks, as you mentioned, and an extension to emergency unemployment programs. What impact will this aid have?
Yeah, the smaller relief payments will certainly help some. It's $600 for every adult and child, and those payments started going out this week. Most people will get the money through direct deposit, which started on Tuesday night. If the government doesn't have your bank information, you might get a paper check instead. Those started going out yesterday. The unemployment aid in the package is perhaps more critical. The Relief Act extended two emergency jobless programs that right now are covering more than 13 million people. And those folks otherwise would have been cut off right after Christmas. As a result of the Relief Act, they'll continue to get benefits through the middle of March. Now, because there was so much foot-dragging here in Washington, there could be some hiccups in those payments. People may miss a week or two, but they won't lose eligibility, and eventually they should get those benefits retroactively. The other thing the relief bill does is it temporarily boosts unemployment payments by $300 a week, and that should be a big help for about 19 million people who are counting on jobless benefits right now.
The unemployment numbers came out today. And what do these numbers tell us?
Yeah, we learned today that another 1.1 million people applied for jobless benefits last week. That was down about 9% from the week before, but it's still, you know, a lot of newly jobless people by historical standards. It shows that we continued to see layoffs all through the holiday season, and at least some of that likely results from the still raging pandemic, which is making it hard for a lot of in-person type businesses to operate right now.
Mm-hmm. I have about 30 seconds with you. After this roller coaster year, the stock market hit record highs this week. What is going on there?
Yeah, it's been a remarkable turnaround. Stocks fell sharply in the early months of the pandemic, but they've since fully recovered, and then some. Investors are really bullish about what the future holds, even as the rest of the economy is still climbing cautiously out of a deep hole with some slippery footholds along the way.
Yeah, so much to watch for here. Thank you so much for the work you've done this year. That's NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Well, there have been so many times over the last 4 years that we have asked our next guest, what's going to happen with Brexit? Voters approved the UK's divorce from the European Union back in 2016, but it was only on Christmas Eve of this year that the terms were finalized, so to speak. And yesterday, the British Parliament approved a new trade deal. The BBC's political correspondent Rob Watson joins us by Skype to answer our questions again. And Rob, the day is finally here. There is a post-Brexit trade deal. What are your thoughts at this moment?
Well, my thoughts are that it is the most astonishing moment in British politics, and I would argue possibly the most important moment since the end of the Second World War, because Britain has definitively left the European Union. It's left its single market, its customs union, things actually that Britain helped to found. So anyone thinking that the UK is somehow sort of with this deal staying sort of in the EU, not at all. I mean, Britain is making a decisive break from the European Union. It'll be far more distant in terms of its economic relationship and in terms of a political relationship formally, that there won't really be one at all. I mean, it is that dramatic. And I would just say finally this, the vote that we had in Parliament on Wednesday, it really completed the sort of transformation of the British political landscape, where both of its main parties, the Conservative Party and Labour, now accept that Britain has left the European Union.
Mm-hmm. The people who wanted the UK to leave the EU see this as a victory, but it really looks like the nation is still really divided over this issue.
That is true. I mean, I don't think you can have an issue that has been as profoundly divisive as this has been and just click your fingers and expect it to go away. And I think it is important to say nothing has divided the UK like Brexit in my lifetime, and I think you could argue since the 17th century. It's partly because it hasn't been about the usual divisions in politics based on, I don't know, class or economics. This is about identity. It's about how you see yourself, how you see Britain, how you see the rest of the world, and getting over that division is going to take some work.
Well, Brexit, you could argue, cost two prime ministers their jobs, but Boris Johnson, I mean, he got it done. Does this Conservative Party have anything else to hang its hat on going forward?
That is a very interesting question. I think there's no doubt that at this precise moment, Boris Johnson just looks supreme. I mean, there he was, the man who led the Brexit victory in 2016, something that's been described as a pseudo-revolution, a quasi-revolution in British politics. And now that he's the man who's led Britain out of the European Union. I think the challenge comes now in Brexit going from being something theoretical that we've all been arguing about these last 4.5 years to being something real. I mean, Britain really has left the European Union, its single market, its customs union. So it seems to me that this is about, okay, well, now that it's real, is it any good? And I think Mr. Johnson's fate will depend on that. I mean, it's all very well to have lots of arguments. Yes, he's triumphed. He can say Britain's got back its sovereignty. And now we're going to see whether it works. And to go right to your question, one of the things that's really been missing from Mr. Johnson's government and from Mr. Johnson is lots of emphasis on we need to leave the European Union to get back control over our laws and ability to diverge from the EU. But what he hasn't said at this point is to what end? I mean, what exactly is Brexit for? So I guess that's what we'll be looking for in 2021 and beyond.
what is it for? And are people and businesses going to feel the effects of this departure? I mean, we've been talking all of this time about how painful this might be.
Yes, there's no doubt if you're in business selling stuff to the European Union, life is going to become more complicated because there will now be regulatory checks that didn't exist before because of leaving the single market and customs declarations because we used to be in a customs union. And the British government itself estimates that there will be something like 200 million, yes, million, extra custom forms a year. Now, if you're in a kind of business that's selling services to the European Union, so the stuff that Britain is really good at, like financial services, insurance, the deal doesn't cover that at all. So life is going to be really uncertain if you're a banker or you're an insurance agent, and some of that will be the subject of further negotiations with the EU. So certainly for businesses, they're glad that there's a deal, that there wasn't a no-deal Brexit, but they are very apprehensive about what is to come.
That's the BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson. Thanks again for speaking with us, and we wish you a very happy 2021.
Well, happy new year to you, and glad to be able to bring Brexit to some sort of conclusion for you all.
And a note about tonight's New Year's Eve celebration in New York City, where there will be some events but a lot fewer people. The New York City Police Department is closing Times Square to vehicles and pedestrians today. It's the first time they've done this in years. Police also say they will disperse onlookers venturing into the area that's closest to the ball drop. Even guests at five-star hotels in the area have been told to stay inside. One doctor in Alabama describes the COVID-19 infection rise there as like a bathtub filling up with water and the drain is blocked. Right now, the state ranks among the top 10 states in coronavirus cases per capita. Dr. Jeannie Marazzo is the director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, and she joins us now to talk about this. And doctor, hospitals there are really struggling. One mid-sized hospital north of Birmingham has an ICU that was last week at 180% capacity. That's stunning. What does that even look like?
Well, the situation in Alabama, as in many states that don't have really expansive, particularly ICU capacity, is increasingly precipitous, I would say. Right now, we have almost half of our ICU beds throughout the state filled with patients who have COVID. And that is not only an indicator of how bad our COVID pandemic is, it's an indicator of how compromised our ability to care for everybody else without COVID is. We're also number third in the U.S. for per capita inpatient rate right now in terms of hospitalizations. And yesterday, we exceeded our record for all patients hospitalized with COVID in the state. It's now over 2,800. And the worst part of all of this, of course, is that we don't even think we've seen the post-Christmas and post-New Year's surge.
I mean, you say you expect a spike on top of a surge on top of a spike after the holidays. How do hospitals there prepare with all of what you're saying is happening there with the situation?
So there are practically every other hour reassessments of the situation. And part of the challenge, of course, is that the flow of patients through hospitals is very dynamic. You've got ambulances coming in, some physicians and nurses having to go out to ambulances in the ambulance bay to assess patients. So it is really taxing everyone's not just bed capacity, but personnel capacity and operational capacity. We are having a lot of sick healthcare workers out now, particularly nurses. Our positivity rate in the state right now is almost 40%. So the risk of healthcare workers getting infected is really significant, and that really takes them out from being able to provide care in the acute setting.
Well, Governor Kay Ivey issued a COVID-19 state of emergency back in March and has issued several supplemental declarations since then. How has that helped?
The governor has been very steadfast in her support of a mask ordinance, which I think has helped a lot. If you look at some of our numbers compared to our neighboring states who have not done the same thing, we have generally been doing a little bit better. I think the challenge has been that even the level of mask ordinance that we have in the last month has not been enough to overcome the consequences of people traveling and getting together in the Thanksgiving and the Christmas holidays. So the challenge really is that when people get together to eat or drink, they necessarily don't use a mask. And even if they're trying to have some social distancing, when you have a group of five people together in a dining room or in a living room or a kitchen, there is really no way you're not going to have enough proximity to get transmission.
And speaking of that, I mean, it's New Year's Eve. What, if any, restrictions are in place there today?
The only restrictions in place are really the mask ordinance. So there are restaurants that remain open. There are no restrictions on public gathering numbers. There is guidance for social distancing, but people are not being fined for wearing a mask. So that's certainly not happening here.
Doctor, it's been a long year for you and your colleagues and healthcare workers across the country. What's your hope for 2021, and what message do you want people to remember as we head into the new year?
My hope is that the vaccines that we have available and should have increasingly available over the next 2 months will afford us enough protection to get ahead of this tidal wave. But if we can really ramp up immunization, particularly for healthcare workers and first responders, we can at least make sure that our acute care facilities are staffed and our people who are living in long-term care facilities can be protected. And hopefully we'll be able to get the vaccines into kids as well so that we can look at having a somewhat normal fall for school. And that would be really, really terrific.
Dr. Jeannie Marazzo is the director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
For the first time, new federal guidelines issued this week includes recommendations for breastfeeding. The U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services recommend infants be fed breast milk exclusively for the first 6 months of life and should continue through at least the first year of life and longer if desired. But what's left unsaid are the barriers women face to breastfeeding. Carrie Pawlowski is a lactation consultant at Mott's Children's Hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And Carrie, according to the CDC, fewer than half of infants in the U.S. are exclusively breastfed through the first 3 months of life, and only a quarter are exclusively breastfed through 6 months, even though that's the recommendation. Remind us of the barriers some women face.
So the barriers that women face are lack of support for them. A lot of women now with a pandemic going on and even before that did not have support from families and just from people in the community. It's very hard to breastfeed sometimes, and a lot of women don't get the support they need or the education that they need.
Right. There are some employers who are not supportive of breastfeeding. Some people don't have time to pump during their workday. And this recommendation comes in a pandemic. Many women are under a lot of pressure juggling work and childcare. Frontline workers who are mothers are at higher risk of contracting the coronavirus. How has the pandemic affected breastfeeding?
Well, since these women are isolated now from other women and from their families, they just don't get the support and the care that they need. And breastfeeding can be very hard in the beginning, especially if they don't know what they're doing. They're first-time moms. Their partner has to go back to work. They're isolated by themselves. And that can be very, very stressful for the moms.
What do you tell moms as a lactation consultant, especially those who may be dealing with what you just told us?
Well, I try to tell them to, you know, there are Facebook groups out there. They can talk to other moms, you know, Skype with their family, FaceTime with their family. Also, we try to just give them support and tell them they're doing the best they can do, because sometimes it's very hard. And I think a lot of us in the medical profession don't realize that if just being a mom home, a new mom, and not knowing really what to do.
This is also a racial equity issue. Despite the known health benefits, the CDC estimates that Black infants are less likely to be breastfed than white infants. I would guess a lot of that has to do with economics, but why is that?
I do believe some of it is with economics, but also it is the lack of support that these moms get. And it might be family members that didn't breastfeed, so they don't really realize how important it is. Or it can be just people will assume if they're uneducated or poor, that they may not want to breastfeed and they don't get the support.
We know that there are laws now that require workplaces to provide a place that's not a bathroom for mothers to pump. Lactation consultants like yourself are covered by insurance. But what kinds of other supports do women need? You mentioned some of the things you point women to, Facebook groups, other types of women's groups. But what possibly on a federal level needs to happen to really allow for this recommendation to be taken?
So on a federal level, we do have a law that allows women to pump during breaks at work. But I think education is a big thing, Tanya, because it should start in schools when women are young. We need to have groups out there for moms to be able to go to or talk to other people. There are, like with WIC, there are peer counselors and stuff. And there is also a Black Mothers Breastfeeding Association, but more groups like that for moms who are more at risk.
I'm thinking about the disparity, though, because I'm thinking about, although there is a federal law that requires workplaces to provide places for women to breastfeed, how is that enforced? Say if you work in a meatpacking plant or you work in a field, these are types of workplaces that are different than, say, if you work in an office.
That is correct. And you know, we have to stick together as women, I think, too, and, you know, go into our government and say we need this more for women, because right now there isn't the support out there. Like in certain companies, you know, they have paid maternity leave and other companies they don't.
And, you know, one thing we didn't talk about in this conversation is why breastfeeding is important.
So it is considered the ideal nutrition for your babies. Plus, it has lots of antibodies, so it's protective against viruses. So I think those are things that they're realizing out there, that it's very important to give your baby breast milk if you can.
How much do you think this recommendation will help in this push to change perceptions around breastfeeding? There is a stigma in many places for women to breastfeed in public, for instance.
And that hopefully will change as more and more states, you know, pass laws that allow women to breastfeed in public and make it more normal for everybody.
That's Gary Pawlowski, a lactation consultant at Mott's Children's Hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Tanya, very much.
New York City's Chinatown stretches more than 20 blocks through Lower Manhattan, and before the pandemic, it was a thriving and lively area filled with restaurants, grocery stores, and street vendors. Unfortunately, many are now struggling. WNYC's Catherine Fung reports on how the situation has prompted second-generation Chinese New Yorkers to use their tech savviness to help family businesses.
Over the summer, Connie Lai was having dinner with her dad, the owner of Go Believe Bakery in Chinatown. The bakery had closed in the spring, and sales were still down by 75%.
I asked him, okay, what are you doing in terms of marketing or, you know, reaching more people?
His answer was, nothing really. Connie asked if she could help out by posting on Instagram.
I was like, yeah, all you have to do is take pictures for me, you know, when the bread comes out.
Her dad was willing to try it, and she says the pictures helped drum up publicity. They even got requests for orders from other states.
I think that's something he didn't imagine before.
Lai says she was never really involved in the family business. She has a full-time job in the tech industry. But the pandemic has pushed her to find ways to help.
I can't make bread. That's not my skills. I just knew that this is something that he loved, and I wanted to support him in the way that I can.
It's one example of how young Chinese New Yorkers are trying to help local businesses, many of them owned by first-generation immigrants, get online and adapt. 30-year-old Victoria Lee says some were already doing that before the pandemic while working in their family businesses. The bleak economy has accelerated that trend.
I think COVID has taken it to a new level, that there's a sense of, like, I really want to help my family's business now, and I need to take a proactive effort.
Lee is the co-founder of Welcome to Chinatown, a merchant support initiative she started back in March. By that point, Chinatown's businesses were already hard hit by COVID-19. Fears of the virus and xenophobia had kept customers away since January, after the virus first emerged in China. Lee noticed New Yorkers in other neighborhoods were buying gift cards to support businesses, but places in Chinatown weren't equipped to sell them.
A lot of Chinatown small businesses are cash only. So we started Welcome to Chinatown as a way to try to set them up on some type of gift card platform.
She says it's about more than helping a single business. She and her friends consider the neighborhood part of their cultural identity. Even after her family moved away from the area, she went to Chinatown every weekend as a kid.
There used to be VHS stores that you would rent Hong Kong television shows. We would do that, grocery shop, and we'd spend the whole day in Chinatown. Then it all culminate at my grandmother's apartment. We'd have Sunday dinners.
She says she's worried that longtime neighborhood businesses won't be around much longer. And Wellington Chen, the director of the Chinatown Local Development Corporation, points out that while grassroots support has been heartening, businesses still need more help.
That wave that's hitting us is far greater than anything that we can do alone.
Even if businesses are eligible for a second round of Paycheck Protection Program loans, he says with winter here, indoor dining shut down, and COVID-19 on the rise, he expects a lot more places in Chinatown to close over the next several months. For NPR, this is Catherine Fung in New York.
The Star-Spangled Banner, Old Glory, the red, white, and blue. Our flag has many names, and it symbolizes different things to different people. Over the past 4 years, the U.S. flag has been predominantly displayed by supporters of President Trump. So much so that when we asked listeners what they thought about the American symbol these days, many echo the thoughts of Heather Ivey of South Carolina.
A reckless band of miscreants has stolen and perverted that figure for me. They have usurped our nation's symbol of unity and cheaply rebranded it with disregard and mockery. They have changed the meaning of the grand old flag for me. I do not want to be misidentified as a Make America Great Again person. So yes, my relationship and my perspective of the flag has certainly morphed.
But then in November, when President-elect Joe Biden won the 2020 election, many of his supporters took to the streets to celebrate, waving U.S. flags that they had stored away for years. Listener Lorraine Dewey of North Carolina says she felt compelled to hang up her flag again.
God bless America. I can hang my flag out now and not have it represent hate and bigotry and just the god-awful stuff that's been going on for the last 4 years. I can't be any more excited than I am right now, and I want you to know I love you all.
For Judy Bartek of Massachusetts, Biden's win renewed her love for the flag.
It represents our caring about one another, being kind, respectful for our differences. It represents the opportunity for healing as a nation.
For other listeners, President Trump's loss has made them question if the flag represents them anymore, while others told us they've never questioned the flag and that it stands for freedom. So what do all of these evolving perceptions of the flag really mean? And what do they say about the state of our politics? Ben Gaskins, professor of political science at Lewis and Clark University in Portland, has been looking into this, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
President Trump politicized the significance of the flag, but this isn't the first time that the U.S. flag has divided the country. The Vietnam War and more recently 9/11 were two national events that galvanized people either around the flag or against the flag. What symbolic role does the flag play?
Well, the flag is one of the most meaningful symbols of what it means to be American for a majority of the country. And polls have consistently shown that the flag represents to people these ideas of freedom and liberty, equality, and democracy. And the United States has long been thought of to be a creedal nation. That means that people can be Americans if they adopt this American creed, regardless of their race, religion, or national origin. But that creed, what it means to be American, is contested and it's complicated, and it means different things to different people across the political spectrum. And so how people approach the flag and how they view it will also be dependent upon their political ideology in the moment that we are in. But Americans have long had a strong notion of civil religion, where patriotic sentiments are often closely intertwined with their religious sentiments and their religious identity. And Americans tend to sacralize our founding documents and individuals like George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and other of our founders. And so that means that our civil religion affects our political discourse, and it takes on kind of a religious character, where political leaders use patriotic and religious language to demonstrate their Americanness, to elevate political discourse, and also to really play up into this mythologizing of American exceptionalism and American character. And so Americans follow suit, and a Gallup poll shows that 86% of Americans see displaying the flag as an important part of patriotism and demonstrating this American character.
How has President Trump's use of the flag and the way his administration has embraced the stars and stripes different or similar to past presidents?
Well, all presidents and political actors will use patriotism and the symbols of the nation. It's not unique for President Trump to try to use symbols of the country like the flag and patriotism to really justify his presidency and to try to, I guess, unify the country. But that last question about unification, I think, really does stand out for President Trump, where patriotism and these symbols of the country, the flag itself, has moved more to become a political weapon rather than a statement of unity. So President Trump has been very clear in his efforts to connect his policies and his persona and support for him with support for the country and patriotism. He's criticized his political opponents as being un-American or even hating America for being unpatriotic. President Trump has criticized very strongly athletes for not standing for the national anthem and argued that they are disrespecting the flag and therefore disrespecting the military and the country overall. And so I think that is really different than what we have seen in the past. And it helps to understand why we have seen such an extension of the partisan divide on how the flag is perceived and how patriotism is understood.
That wedge that you're referring to, it seems to be closing just a bit. We've seen, especially after the presidential election, a movement of what people call reclaiming of the flag. What exactly does that mean?
We've seen over a long period of time, Republicans being somewhat more patriotic or willing to say that they are patriotic or extremely proud to be an American than Democrats. But for Democrats especially, this seems to be very contingent on who is in power. During Obama's administration, Democrats' patriotism or their willingness to say that they are very proud to be American went up pretty substantially, went up over 10 points. And when Trump was in office, Democrats' support or their pride in being American dropped in half. And so it seems to be very contingent. And part of that is because of President Trump's desire to link support for him and support for his policies with being American and with being patriotic. And so as Trump is preparing to leave office, many people on the left and Democrats are trying to reclaim that universality of these American symbols like the flag, to say that even though conservatives and Republicans tend to report being more patriotic, of having greater pride in their American identity, that these symbols and these attitudes are not a partisan thing, that Democrats and people on the left love their country just as much as Republicans and people on the right, even if they have different attitudes and different approaches to demonstrating that. There seems to be a concerted effort by many groups on the left to try to argue that what the American flag represents, what Americanism means, is something different, that it represents inclusiveness, that it represents equality and freedom in a way that is very important for people on the left and their ideology.
And with that, though, Is there really any other symbol that can really bring together people in this way, a symbol that holds the same value? What other symbols of unity might actually emerge or need to emerge to provide what you're talking about?
It's a great question. And one of the challenges of our current political moment is we are polarized not just on policy, but we are polarized socially as well. And so Republicans and Democrats not only have different attitudes towards spending and social welfare and things like that, but they have different ways of living, different ways of seeing the world. And so there are fewer things that the political parties will have in common in terms of their lifestyle, their and things that they enjoy, the things that represent who they are, where they live. People are becoming more fragmented in all of those patterns. So I think it's heartening in one way that there is such an effort by groups on the left to reclaim the flag, because it really is one of the few symbols that people across the political spectrum really can hold to.
That's Ben Gaskins, professor of political science at Lewis and Clark University in Portland, Oregon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we want to thank all of our listeners who wrote and called in to share their thoughts on the U.S. flag. The Associated Press recently named LeBron James and Naomi Osaka as its Athletes of the Year. James led the Los Angeles Lakers to the NBA title. He also spoke out for Black Lives Matter.
It's not a movement. I don't like the word movement because unfortunately in America and society, there ain't been no damn movement for us. There ain't been no movement.
And when she won the U.S. Open, Osaka wore masks that bore the names of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor.
I just felt like while I'm here, while for some reason there's a TV camera on me, I might as well use it to the best of my ability.
Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, how did these two voices change the discourse?
I think they both had a big impact, especially LeBron James, just because he's the most looked at and noted athlete in the world. And him bringing to the forefront, not that it wasn't already there, but adding his voice to the many voices, along with Oprah Winfrey and Beyonce, about what happened with Breonna Taylor. You know, everyone knows her name now, but it wasn't written in stone that would be. It took many people who already had a platform talking about her and what happened to her in Louisville to raise her story to that of national attention. And with Osaka, you know, for her sport, she's a great tennis player. You could argue the best tennis player, but she was the most active in the sport of tennis in terms of raising awareness for these issues. You needed to have the marriage of the great on-court play with the sentiment that marks the zeitgeist of the time, and that's why these two were appropriate choices.
I'm also thinking about just the differences in the way collectively we're talking about all of this along with these athletes. It was different a few years ago with Colin Kaepernick.
It was when the NFL came down hard on Colin Kaepernick, and I think we could fairly say blackballed him, or at least didn't give him an honest chance to ever make a squad because of his beliefs and his acting out on those beliefs. The consensus was, whether you agreed with that was fair or unfair, well, of course that's what the NFL is going to do. That's who the NFL is. That's the part of the culture that they reflect. And now it's different. Now it would seem if Kaepernick engaged in such an action that there would be no repercussions. In fact, many NFL athletes have been very vocal, and they have been, to some extent, a large extent, supported by the league. So it really has changed so much, at least in terms of what the leagues themselves, how they countenance their athletes speaking out on issues important to them.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about some of the sports performances this year. We saw some great ones on the courts and on the field this year when sports resumed. Here's one of them. That's how it sounded on Fox when the L.A. Dodgers won the World Series for the first time in 32 years. What were the highlights for you?
Yeah, in terms of on-the-field performance, the playoffs really got good after an odd baseball season, only 60 games playing before cardboard cutouts, and the Dodgers were the best team. Although now, what occupies your mind is Justin Turner, who tested positive for COVID, going out and celebrating with his teammates. I don't know if it was overshadowed, but that's what I think of when I think of Dodgers celebrating. In basketball, their bubble worked really well, as did the WNBA, NBA bubbles. The Lakers, another example, well, credit to Los Angeles, I guess. They need some good news. Their team was dominant, the Seattle Storm, so in the WNBA. So let's celebrate the things that we did have and were able to have. Let's note the things we didn't. And I think if we have a note of ambivalence about, say, the college football playoffs, which are going to happen, but maybe they shouldn't, I think that's fine too.
Mm-hmm. There's also so much loss this year, Mike. We lost Kobe Bryant. He died along with his daughter and seven other people in a helicopter crash. And then later this year, soccer legend Diego Maradona died. Can you put these losses in the sports world into perspective?
Yeah. Doesn't it seem like that was from a different era? It was 2020. It was just before the pandemic hit in 2020. And there were so many athletes who we lost. Just a few weeks ago on the show, we talked about the death of the track star Rafer Johnson, who became this cultural symbol and a Hollywood actor. And he actually, you know, tackled Sirhan Sirhan after he shot Bobby Kennedy in Los Angeles. Vicky Wood, who was one of the first female NASCAR drivers in 1957 in Michigan, in 1959 at the Daytona International Speedway, she died. You know, one of the greatest pitchers of all time, Tom Seaver, died. And then just a few days ago, Phil Niekro, the last of the great knuckleballers, died. So there was so much loss, of course, because of the pandemic and because of other circumstances, too.
What are you looking forward to in 2021?
I'm looking forward to sports being a reflection of society, as they always have been. And I'm looking for sports to come roaring back, because what will that mean? What's the implication if you work up from that premise? It's that society has recovered. And I don't think you can have, like we talked a little while ago on this show, that sports being the reward for a functional society. I would like to be rewarded, because you'll know what that means.
I can't stop thinking about that. It's true. And I'm with you on that. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always, and you have a happy new year.
You too, and you're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.